angrily for a moment. Then he convulsed and cried out, sounding more like a wounded animal than a man.
"I am a tool in your hand," he gasped.
"Lord Haliax."
"I am a tool in your hand, Lord Haliax,"
Cinder amended as he crumpled, trembling to his knees.
"Who knows the inner turnings of your name, Cinder?"
The words were spoken with a slow patience like a schoolmaster reciting a forgotten lesson. Cinder wrapped shaking arms around his midsection and hunched over, closing his eyes.
"You, Lord Haliax,
who keeps you safe from the Amir, the singers, the scythe, from all that would harm you in the world?"
Haliax asked with calm politeness, as if genuinely curious as to what the answer might be.
"You, Lord Haliax!"
Cinder's voice was a quiet shred of pain.
"And whose purpose do you serve?"
"Your purpose, Lord Haliax!"
The words were choked out.
"Yours! None other!"
The tension left the air, and Cinder's body suddenly went slack. He fell forwards onto his hands, and beads of sweat fell from his face to patter on the ground like rain. His white hair hung limp around his face.
"Thank you, Lord,"
he gasped out earnestly.
"I will not forget again."
"You will. You are too fond of your little cruelties. All of you."
Haliax's hooded face swept back and forth to look at each of the figures sitting around the fire. They stirred uncomfortably.
"I am glad I decided to accompany you today. You are straying, indulging in whimsy. Some of you seem to have forgotten what it is we seek, what we wish to achieve."
The others sitting around the fire stirred uneasily. The hood turned back to Cinder.
"But you have my forgiveness. Perhaps if not for these remindings, it would be I who would forget."
There was an edge to the last of his words.
"Now, finish what?"
His cool voice trailed away as his shadowed hood slowly tilted to look toward the sky. There was an expectant silence. Those sitting around the fire grew perfectly still, their expressions intent. In unison, they tilted their heads as if looking at the same point in the twilight sky, as if trying to catch the scent of something on the wind. A feeling of being watched pulled at my attention. I felt a tenseness, a subtle change in the texture of the air. I focused on it, glad for the distraction, glad for anything that might keep me from thinking clearly for just a few more seconds.
"They come," Haliax said quietly.
He stood and shadow seemed to boil outward from him like a dark fog.
"Quickly, to me."
The others rose from their seats around the fire. Cinder scrambled to his feet and staggered a half dozen steps towards the fire. Haliax spread his arms and the shadow surrounding him bloomed like a flower unfolding. Then each of the others turned with a studied ease and took a step toward Haliax, into the shadow surrounding him. But as their feet came down, they slowed, and gently, as if they were made of sand with wind blowing across them, they faded away. Only Cinder looked back, a hint of anger in his nightmare eyes. Then they were gone. I will not burden you with what followed. How I ran from body to body, frantically feeling for the signs of life as Ben had taught me. My futile attempt at digging a grave, how I scrabbled in the dirt until my fingers were bloody and raw, how I found my parents. It was in the darkest hours of the night when I found our wagon. Our horse had dragged it nearly 100 yards down the road before he died. It seemed so normal inside, so tidy and calm. I was struck by how much the back of the wagon smelled like the two of them. I lit every lamp and candle in the wagon. The light was no comfort, but it was the honest gold of real fire, untinged with blue. I took down my father's loot case, I lay in my parents' bed with the lute beside me. My mother's pillow smelled of her hair, of an embrace. I did not mean to sleep, but sleep took me. I woke, coughing, with everything in flames around me. It had been the candles, of course. Still numb with shock, I gathered a few things into a bag. I was slow and aimless, unafraid as I pulled Ben's book from under my burning mattress. What horror could a simple fire hold for me now? I put my father's lute into its case. It felt like I was stealing, but I couldn't think of anything else that would remind me of them. Both their hands had brushed its wood 1,000,000 times. Then I left. I walked into the forest and kept going until dawn began to brighten the eastern edges of the sky. As the birds began to sing, I stopped and set down my bag. I brought out my father's lute and clutched it to my body. Then I began to play. My fingers hurt, but I played anyway. I played until my fingers bled on the strings. I played until the sun shone through the trees. I played until my arms ached. I played, trying not to remember, until I fell asleep. Chapter 17. Interlude. Autumn. Kvothe held out a hand to Chronicler, then turned to his student, frowning.
Stop looking at me like that, Bast.
Bast looked close to tears.
Oh, Reshi,
he choked out.
I had no idea.
Kvothe gestured as if cutting the air with the side of his hand. There's no reason you should, Bast, and no reason to make an issue out of it.
But Reshi...
Kvothe gave his student a severe look.
What, Bast, should I weep and tear my hair, curse Telu and his angels, beat my chest? No, that is low drama.
His expression softened somewhat. I appreciate your concern, but this is just a piece of the story, not even the worst piece, and I am not telling it to garner sympathy. Kvothe pushed his chair back from the table and came to his feet.
Besides, all of this happened long ago.
He made a dismissive gesture. Time is the great healer, and so on. He rubbed his hands together.
Now I'm going to bring in enough wood to get us through the night. There'll be a chill if I'm any judge of weather. You could get a couple of loaves ready to bake while I'm out and try to collect yourself. I refuse to tell the rest of this story with you making blubbery cow eyes at me.
With that, Kvothe walked behind the bar and out through the kitchen towards the back door of the inn. Bast scrubbed roughly at his eyes, then watched his master go.
He's fine as long as he's busy, Bast said softly.
I beg your pardon?
Chronicler said reflexively. He shifted awkwardly in his seat as if he wanted to get to his feet, but couldn't think of a polite way to excuse himself. Bast gave a warm smile, his eyes a human blue again.
I was so excited when I heard who you were, that he was going to tell his story. His mood's been so dark lately, and there's nothing to shake him out of it, nothing to do but sit and brood. I'm sure that remembering the good times will...
Bast grimaced.
I'm not saying this very well. I'm sorry for earlier. I wasn't thinking straight.
No, no,
Chronicler stammered hastily.
I'm the one. It was my fault. I'm sorry.
Bast shook his head.
You were just surprised, but you only tried to bind me.
His expression grew a little pained.
Not that it was pleasant, mind. It feels like being kicked between your legs, but all over your body. It makes you feel sick and weak, but it's just pain. It wasn't like you'd actually wounded me.
Bast looked embarrassed.
I was going to do more than hurt you. I might have killed you before I even stopped to think.
Before an uncomfortable silence developed, Chronicler said,
Why don't we take his word that we were both suffering from blinding idiocy and leave it at that?
chronicler managed a sickly smile that was heartfelt, in spite of the circumstances.
Peace.
He extended his hand.
Peace.
They shook hands with much more genuine warmth than they had earlier. As Bast reached across the table, his sleeve pulled back to reveal a bruise blossoming around his wrist. Bast self-consciously pulled his cuff back into place.
From when he grabbed me,
he said quickly.
He's stronger than he looks. Don't mention it to him, he'll only feel bad.
Gvoth emerged from the kitchen and shut the door behind himself. Looking around, he seemed surprised that it was a mild autumn afternoon rather than the springtime forest of his story. He lifted the handles of a flat-bottomed barrow and trundled it out into the woods behind the inn, his feet crunching in the fallen leaves. Not too far into the trees was the winter's wood supply. Cord on cord of oak and ash were stacked to make tall, crooked walls between the trunks of trees. Gvoth tossed two pieces of firewood into the wheelbarrow where they struck the bottom like a muted drum. Another two followed them. His motions were precise, his face blank, his eyes far away. As he continued to load the barrow, he moved slower and slower, like a machine winding down. Eventually, he stopped completely and stood for a long minute, still as stone. Only then did his composure break, and even with no one there to see, he hid his face in his hands and wept quietly, his body racked with wave on wave of heavy, silent sobs. Chapter 18. Roads to Safe Places. Perhaps the greatest faculty our minds possess is the ability to cope with pain. Classic thinking teaches us of the four doors of the mind which everyone moves through according to their need. Sleep offers us a retreat from the world and all its pain. Sleep marks passing time, giving us distance from the things that have hurt us. When a person is wounded, they will often fall unconscious. Similarly, someone who hears traumatic news will often swoon or faint. This is the mind's way of protecting itself from pain by stepping through the first door. Second is the door of forgetting. Some wounds are too deep to heal or too deep to heal quickly. In addition, many memories are simply painful, and there is no healing to be done. The saying, time heals all wounds, is false. Time heals most wounds. The rest are hidden behind this door. Third is the door of madness. There are times when the mind is dealt such a blow it hides itself in insanity. While this may not seem beneficial, it is. There are times when reality is nothing but pain, and to escape that pain, the mind must leave reality behind. Last is the door of death, the final resort. Nothing can hurt us after we are dead, or so we have been told. After my family was killed, I wandered deep into the forest and slept. My body demanded it, and my mind used the first door to dull the pain. The wound was covered until the proper time for healing could come. In self-defense, a good portion of my mind simply stopped working, went to sleep, if you will. While my mind slept, many of the painful parts of the previous day were ushered through the second door. Not completely. I did not forget what had happened, but the memory was dulled as if seen through thick gauze. If I wanted to, I could have brought to memory the faces of the dead, the memories of the man with black eyes. But I did not want to remember. I pushed those thoughts away and let them gather dust in a seldom-used corner of my mind. I dreamed not of blood, glassy eyes, and the smell of burning hair, but of gentler things. And slowly, the wound began to grow numb. I dreamed I was walking through the forest with plain-faced Lackleth, the woodsman who had travelled with our troop when I was younger. He walked silently through the underbrush while I kicked up more noise than a wounded ox dragging an overturned cart. After a long period of comfortable silence, I stopped to look at a plant. He came quietly up behind me.
"Sagebird," he said, "you can tell by the edge."
He reached past me and gently stroked the appropriate part of the leaf. It looked like a beard. I nodded.
"This is willow. You can chew the bark to lessen pains."
It was bitter and slightly gritty.
"This is its root. Don't touch the leaves."
I didn't.
"This is Banbury. Small fruits are safe to eat when red, but never when shading from green to yellow to orange. This is how you set your feet when you want to walk silently."
It made my calves ache.
"This is how you part the brush quietly, leaving no sign of your passing. This is where you find the dry wood. This is how you keep the rain off when you don't have canvas. This is pater root. You can eat it, but it tastes bad. These," he gestured, "straight rod, orange stripe, never eat them. The one with little knobs on it is burum. You should only eat it if you have just eaten something like straight rod. It will make you kick up whatever's in your stomach. This is how you set a snare that won't kill a rabbit. This snare will."
He looped the string first one way, then another. As I watched his hands manipulate the string, I realized it was no longer Lackleth, but Abenthy. We were riding in the wagon, and he was teaching me how to tie sailor's knots.
"Knots are interesting things," Ben said as he worked. "The knot will either be the strongest or the weakest part of the rope. It depends entirely on how well one makes the binding."
He held up his hands, showing me an impossibly complex pattern spread between his fingers. His eyes glittered.
"Any questions?"
"Any questions?" my father said. We had stopped early for the day because of a greystone. He sat tuning his lute and was finally going to play his song for my mother and me. We'd been waiting so long. "Are there any questions?" he repeated, as he sat with his back against the great greystone.
"Why do we stop at the waystones?"
"Tradition, mostly, but some people say they marked old roads."
My father's voice changed and became Ben's voice.
"Safe roads. Sometimes roads to safe places, sometimes safe roads leading into danger."
Ben held one hand out to it as if feeling the warmth of a fire.
"But there is a power in them. Only a fool would deny that."
Then Ben was no longer there, and there was not one standing stone, but many, more than I had ever seen in one place before. They formed a double circle around me. One stone was set across the top of two others, forming a huge arch with thick shadow underneath. I reached out to touch it and awoke. My mind had covered a fresh pane with the names of 100 roots and berries, 4 ways to light a fire, 9 snares made from nothing but a sapling and string, and where to find fresh water. I thought very little on the other matter of the dream. Ben had never taught me sailor's knots. My father had never finished his song. I took inventory of what I had with me, a canvas sack, a small knife, a ball of string, some wax, a copper penny, 2 iron shims, and Rhetoric and Logic, the book Ben had given me. Aside from my clothes and my father's lute, I had nothing else. I set out looking for drinking water.
"Water comes first,"
Lackleth had told me.
"Anything else you can do without for days."
I considered the lay of the land and followed some animal trails. By the time I found a small spring-fed pool nestled among some birch trees, I could see the sky purpling into dusk behind the trees. I was terribly thirsty, but caution won out, and I took only a small drink. Next, I collected dry wood from the hollows of trees and under canopies. I set a simple snare, I hunted for and found several stalks of motherleaf and spread the sap onto my fingers where they were bloody and torn. The stinging helped distract me from remembering how I had hurt them. Waiting for the sap to dry, I took my first casual look around. Oaks and birches crowded each other for space. Their trunks made patterns of alternating light and dark beneath the canopy of branches. A small rivulet ran from the pool across some rocks and away to the east. It may have been beautiful, but I didn't notice. I couldn't notice. To me, the trees were shelter. The undergrowth a source of nourishment, and the pool reflecting moonlight only reminded me of my thirst. There was also a great rectangular stone lying on its side near the pool. A few days earlier, I would have recognized it as a greystone. Now I saw it as an efficient windbreak, something to put my back against as I slept. Through the canopy, I saw the stars were out. That meant it had been several hours since I had tried the water. Since it hadn't made me sick, I decided it must be safe and took a long drink. Rather than refreshing me, all my drink did was make me aware of how hungry I was. I sat on the stone by the edge of the pool. I stripped the leaves from the stalks of motherleaf and ate one. It was rough, papery, and bitter. I ate the rest, but it didn't help. I took another drink of water, then lay down to sleep, not caring that the stone was cold and hard, or at least pretending not to care. I awoke, took a drink, and went to check the snare I had set. I was surprised to find a rabbit already struggling against the cord. I took out my small knife and remembered how Lackleth had shown me to dress a rabbit. Then I thought of the blood and how it would feel on my hands. I felt sick and vomited. I cut loose the rabbit and walked back to the pool. I took another drink of water and sat on stone. I felt a little lightheaded and wondered if it was from hunger. After a moment, my head cleared and I chided myself for my foolishness. I found some shelf fungus growing on a dead tree and ate it after washing it in the pool. It was gritty and tasted like dirt. I ate all I could find. I set a new snare, one that would kill. Then, smelling rain in the air, I returned to the greystone to make a shelter for my loot. Chapter 19 Fingers and Strings. In the beginning, I was almost like an automaton, thoughtlessly performing the actions that would keep me alive. I ate the second rabbit I caught, and the third. I found a patch of wild strawberries. I dug for roots. By the end of the fourth day, I had everything I needed to survive. A stone-lined fire pit, a shelter for my loot. I'd even assembled a small stockpile of foodstuffs that I could fall back on in case of emergency. I also had one thing I did not need. Time. After I had taken care of immediate needs, I found I had nothing to do. I think this is when a small part of my mind started to slowly reawaken itself. Make no mistake, I was not myself, at least I was not the same person I had been a span of days before. Everything I did I attended to with my whole mind, leaving no part of me free for remembering. I grew thinner and more ragged. I slept in rain or sun, on soft grass, moist earth, or sharp stones with an intensity of indifference that only grief can promote. The only notice I took of my surroundings was when it rained, because then I could not bring out my lute to play, and that pained me. Of course I played. It was my only solace. By the end of the first month, my fingers had calluses hard as stones, and I could play for hours upon hours. I played and played again all of the songs I knew from memory. Then I played the half-remembered songs as well, filling in the forgotten parts as best I could. Eventually, I could play from when I woke until the time I slept. I stopped playing songs I knew and started inventing new ones. I had made up songs before. I had even helped my father compose a verse or two, but now I gave it my whole attention. Some of those songs have stayed with me to this day. Soon after that, I began playing... How can I describe it? I began to play something other than songs. When the sun warms the grass and the breeze cools you, it feels a certain way. I would play until I got the feeling right. I would play until it sounded like warm grass and cool breeze. I was only playing for myself, but I was a harsh audience. I remember spending nearly 3 whole days trying to capture wind turning a leaf. By the end of the 2nd month, I could play things nearly as easily as I saw and felt them. Sun setting behind the clouds, bird taking a drink, dew in the bracken. Somewhere in the 3rd month, I stopped looking outside and started looking inside for things to play. I learned to play Riding in the Wagon with Ben, singing with Father by the fire, watching Shandy dance, grinding leaves when it is nice outside, Mother smiling. Needless to say, playing these things hurt, but it was a hurt like tender fingers on lute strings. I bled a bit and hoped that I would callous soon. Towards the end of summer, one of the strings broke beyond repair. I spent the better part of the day in a mute stupor, unsure of what to do. My mind was still numb and mostly asleep. I focused with a dim shadow of my usual cleverness on my problem. After realizing that I could neither make a string nor acquire a new one, I sat back down and began to learn to play with only 6 strings. In a span, I was nearly as good with 6 strings as I had been with 7. 3 span later, I was trying to play Waiting While It Rains when a 2nd string broke. This time, I didn't hesitate. I stripped off the useless string and started to learn again. It was midway through Reaping when the 3rd string broke. After trying for nearly half a day, I realized that 3 broken strings were too many. So I packed a small dull knife, half a ball of string, and Ben's book into a tattered canvas sack. Then I shouldered my father's lute and began to walk. I tried humming, Snow Falling with the Late Autumn Leaves, Calloused Fingers and a Lute with 4 strings, but it wasn't the same as playing it. My plan was to find a road and follow it to a town. I had no idea how far I was from either and which direction they might lie or what their names might be. I knew I was somewhere in the Southern Commonwealth, but the precise location was buried, tangled up with other memories that I was not eager to unearth. The weather helped me make up my mind. Cool autumn was turning to winter's chill. I knew the weather was warmer to the south, so lacking any better plan, I set the sun on my left shoulder and tried to cover as much distance as I could. The next span was an ordeal. The little food I'd brought with me was soon gone, and I had to stop and forage when I was hungry. Some days I couldn't find water, and when I did, I had nothing I could use to carry it. The small wagon track joined a bigger road, which joined a larger road yet. My feet chafed and blistered against the insides of my shoes. Some nights were bitter cold. There were inns, but aside from the occasional drink I stole from horse troughs, I gave them a wide berth. There were a few small towns as well, but I needed some place larger. Farmers have no need for lute strings. At first, whenever I heard a wagon or a horse approaching, I found myself limping off to hide by the side of the road. I had not spoken with another human since the night my family was killed. I was more akin to a wild animal than a boy of 12. But eventually the road became too large and well-traveled, and I found myself spending more time hiding than walking. I finally braved the traffic and was relieved when I was largely ignored. I had been walking for less than an hour one morning when I heard a wagon coming up behind me. The road was wide enough for two wagons to run abreast, but I moved to the grass at the edge of the road anyway.
"Hey, boy!"
a rough male voice behind me yelled. I didn't turn around.
"Hello, boy!"
I moved farther off the road into the grass without looking behind me. I kept my eyes on the ground beneath my feet. The wagon pulled slowly alongside me. The voice bellowed twice as loud as before.
"Boy! Boy!"
I looked up and saw a weathered old man squinting against the sun. He could have been anywhere from 40 to 70 years old. There was a thick-shouldered, plain-faced young man sitting next to him on the wagon. I guess they were father and son.
"Are you deaf, boy?"
The old man pronounced it deaf. I shook my head.
"You dumb man!"
I shook my head again.
"No."
It felt strange talking to someone. My voice sounded odd, rough and rusty from disuse. He squinted at me.
"You going into the city?"
I nodded, not wanting to talk again.
"Get in then."
He nodded toward the back of the wagon.
"Some won't mind pulling a little whippy like yourself."
He patted the rump of his mule. It was easier to agree than run away, and the blisters on my feet were stinging from the sweat in my shoes. I moved to the back of the open cart and climbed on, pulling my loot after me. The back of the open wagon was about 3/4 full of large burlap bags. A few round, knobby squash had spilled from an open sack and were rolling aimlessly around on the floor. The old man shook the reins, and the mule grudgingly picked up its pace. I picked up the few loose squash and tucked them into the bag that had fallen open. The old farmer gave me a smile over his shoulder.
"Thanks, boy! I'm Seth, and this here is Jake. You might want to be sitting down. A bad bump could tip you over the side."
I sat on one of the bags, tense for no good reason, not knowing what to expect. The old farmer handed the reins to his son and brought a large brown loaf of bread out of a sack that sat between the two of them. He casually tore off a large chunk, spread a thick dab of butter onto it, and handed it back to me. This casual kindness made my chest ache. It had been half a year since I had eaten bread. It was soft and warm, and the butter was sweet. I saved a piece for later, tucking it into my canvas sack. After a quiet 1/4 hour, the old man turned halfway around.
"Do you play that thing, boy?"
He gestured to the loot case. I clutched it closer to my body.
"It's broken."
"Ah,"
he said, disappointed. I thought he was going to ask me to get off, but instead he smiled and nodded to the man beside him.
"We'll just have to be entertaining you instead."
He started to sing Tinker Tanner, a drinking song that is older than God. After a second, his son joined in, and their rough voices made a simple harmony that set something inside me aching, as I remembered other wagons, different songs, a half-forgotten home. Chapter 20. Bloody hands into stinging fists. It was around noon when the wagon turned onto a new road, this one wide as a river and paved with cobbles. At first, there were only a handful of travellers and a wagon or two, but to me it seemed like a great crowd after such a long time alone. We went deeper into the city, and low buildings gave way to taller shops and inns. Trees and gardens were replaced by alleys and cart vendors. The great river of a road grew clogged and choked with the flotsam of 100 carts and pedestrians, dozens of wains and wagons, and the occasional mounted man. There was the sound of horses' hooves, and people shouting, the smell of beer and sweat and garbage and tar. I wondered which city this was, and if I'd been here before. Before. I gritted my teeth and forced myself to think of other things.
"Almost there!"
Seth raised his voice above the din. Eventually, the road opened out into a market. Wagons rolled on the cobbles with a sound like distant thunder. Voices bargained and fought. Somewhere in the distance, a child was crying shrill and high. We rode aimlessly for a while until he found an empty corner in front of a bookshop. Seth stopped the wagon, and I hopped out as they were stretching away the kinks from the road. Then, with a sort of silent agreement, I helped them unload the lumpy sacks from the back of the wagon and pile them to one side. A half an hour later, we were resting among the piled sacks. Seth looked at me, shading his eyes with a hand.
"What are you doing in town today, boy?"
"I need lute strings," I said.
Only then did I realize I didn't know where my father's lute was. I looked around wildly. It wasn't in the wagon where I'd left it, or leaning against the wall, or on the piles of squash. My stomach clenched until I spotted it underneath some loose burlap sacking. I walked over to it and picked it up with shaking hands. The older farmer grinned at me and held out a pair of the knobby squash we'd been unloading.
"How would your mother like it if you brought home a couple of the finest orange butter squash this side of the Eld?"
"No, I can't," I stammered,
pushing away a memory of raw fingers digging in the mud and the smell of burning hair.
I mean, you've already..."
I trailed off, clutching my lute closer to my chest and moving a couple of steps away. He looked at me more closely, as if seeing me for the first time. Suddenly self-conscious, I imagined how I must look, ragged and half-starved. I hugged the lute and backed farther away. The farmer's hands fell to his side and his smile faded.
"Ah, lad,"
he said softly. He set the squash down, then turned back to me and spoke with a gentle seriousness.
"Me and Jake. We'll be here selling until around about sundown. If you find what you're looking for by then, you'd be welcome back on the farm with us. The missus and me could sure use an extra hand some day. You'd be more than welcome, wouldn't he, Jake?"
Jake was looking at me too, pity written across his honest face.
"Sure enough, Pa. She said so right before we left."
The old farmer continued to look at me with serious eyes.
"This is Seaward Square,"
he said, pointing at his feet.
"We'll be here till dark, maybe a little after. You come back if you want a ride."
His eyes turned worried.
"You hear me? You can come back with us."
I continued to back away, step by step, not sure why I was doing it, only knowing that if I went with him, I would have to explain, would have to remember. Anything was better than opening that door.
"No, no, thank you," I stammered. "You've helped me so much, I'll be fine."
I was jostled from behind by a man in a leather apron. Startled, I turned and ran. I heard one of them call out behind me, but the crowd drowned them out. I ran, my heart heavy in my chest. Tarbin is big enough that you cannot walk from one end to the other in a single day, not even if you avoid getting lost or accosted in a tangled web of twisting streets and dead-end alleys. It was too big, actually. It was vast. Immense. Seas of people, forests of buildings, roads wide as rivers. It smelled like urine and sweat and coal smoke and tar. If I had been in my right mind, I never would have gone there. In the fullness of time, I became lost. I took a turn too early or too late, then tried to compensate by cutting through an alley like a narrow chasm between two tall buildings. It wound like a gully carved by a river that had left to find a cleaner bed. Garbage drifted up the walls and filled the cracks between buildings and the alcove doorways. After I had taken several turns, I caught the rancid smell of something dead. I turned a corner and staggered against a wall as pain stars blinded me. I felt rough hands grab hold of my arms. I opened my eyes to see an older boy. He was twice my size, with dark hair and savage eyes. The dirt that smudged his face gave him the appearance of having a beard, making his young face strangely cruel. Two other boys jerked me away from the wall. I yelped as one of them twisted my arm. The older boy smiled at the sound and ran a hand through his hair.
"What are you doing here, Nelt? You lost?"
His grin broadened. I tried to pull away, but one of the boys twisted my wrist and I gasped.
No, I think he's lost, Pike,
the boy on my right said. The one on my left elbowed me sharply in the side of the head, and the alley tilted crazily around me. Pike laughed.
I'm looking for the woodworks,
I muttered, slightly stunned. Pike's expression turned murderous. His hands grabbed my shoulders.
Did I ask you a question?
He shouted.
Did I say you could talk?
He slammed his forehead into my face and I felt a sharp crack, followed by an explosion of pain.
Hey, Pike!
The voice seemed to come from an impossible direction. A foot nudged my loot case, tipping it over.
Hey, Pike, look at this!
Pike looked down at the hollow thump as the loot case fell flat against the ground.
What did you steal, Nelt?
I didn't steal it.
One of the boys holding my arms laughed.
Ah, yeah, your uncle gave it to you so you could sell it to buy medicine for your sick grandma.
He laughed again while I tried to blink the tears out of my eyes. I heard three clicks as the latches were undone. Then came the distinctive harmonic thrum as the loot was taken out of its case.
Your grandma is gonna be mighty sorry you lost this, Nelt.
Pike's voice was quiet.
Taylor, crush us!
The boy on my right exploded.
Pike! You know how much one of them's worth? Gold, Pike! Don't say Taylor's name like that,
said the boy on my left.
What?
Do not call on Taylor saving the greatest need, for Taylor judges every thought and deed,
he recited.
Taylor and his great glowing penis can piss all over me if that thing isn't worth 20 talents. That means we can get at least 6 from Dyken. Do you know what you can do with that much money? You won't get a chance to do anything with it if you don't quit saying things like that. Taylor watches over us, but he is vengeful.
The second boy's voice was reverent and afraid.
You've been sleeping in that church again, haven't you? You get religion like I get fleas. I'll tie your arms in a knot. Your ma's a penny whore. Don't talk about my mum, Lynn. Iron pennies!
By this time I'd managed to blink my eyes free from the tears, and I could see Pike squatting in the alley. He seemed fascinated by my loot. My beautiful loot. He had a dreamy look in his eyes as he held it, turning it over and over in his dirty hands. A slow horror was dawning on me through the haze of fear and pain. As the two voices grew louder behind me, I began to feel a hot anger inside. I tensed. I couldn't fight them, but I knew if I got hold of my loot and made it into a crowd, I could lose them and be safe again.
But she kept humping away anyway, but now she only got a halfpenny a throw. That's why your head is so soft. You're lucky you don't have a dent, so don't feel bad. That's why you get religious so easy.
The first boy finished triumphantly. I felt only a tenseness on my right side. I tensed too, ready to spring.
But thanks for the warning. I hear Taylor likes to hide behind big clumps of whole shit and...
Suddenly, both of my arms were free, as one boy tackled the other into the wall. I sprinted the 3 steps to Pike, grabbed the loot by the neck and pulled. But Pike was quicker than I expected or stronger. The loot didn't come away in my hand. I was jerked to a halt, and Pike was pulled to his feet. My frustration and anger boiled over. I let go of the loot and threw myself at Pike. I clawed madly at his face and neck, but he was a veteran of too many street fights to let me get close to anything vital. One of my fingernails tore a line of blood across his face from ear to chin. Then he was against me, pressing me back until I hit the alley wall. My head struck brick, and I would have fallen if Pike hadn't been grinding me into the crumbling wall. I gasped for breath, and only then realized I'd been screaming all the while. He smelled like old sweat and rancid oil. His hands pinned my arms to my sides as he pressed me harder into the wall. I was dimly aware that he must have dropped my loot. I gasped for breath again and flailed blindly, knocking my head against the wall again. I found my face pressed into his shoulder and bit down hard. I felt his skin break under my teeth and tasted blood. Pike screamed and jerked away from me. I drew a breath and winced at a tearing pain in my chest. Before I could move or think, Pike grabbed me again. He bludgeoned me up against the wall once, twice, my head whipsawed back and forth, caroming off the wall. Then he grabbed me by the throat, spun me around, and threw me to the ground. That's when I heard the noise, and everything seemed to stop. After my troop was murdered, there were times when I would dream of my parents, alive and singing. In my dream, their deaths had been a mistake, a misunderstanding, a new play they had been rehearsing. And for a few moments I had relief from the great blanketing grief that was constantly crushing me. I hugged them and we laughed at my foolish worry. I sang with them, and for a moment everything was wonderful. Wonderful. But I always woke up, alone, in the dark, by the forest pool. What was I doing out here? Where were my parents? Then I would remember everything, like a wound ripping open. They were dead, and I was terribly alone. And that great weight that had been lifted for just a moment would come crushing down again, worse than before, because I wasn't ready for it. Then I would lay on my back, staring into the dark, with my chest aching and my breath coming hard, knowing deep inside that nothing would ever be right ever again. When Pike threw me to the ground, my body was almost too numb to feel my father's lute being crushed underneath me. The sound it made was like a dying dream, and it brought that same sick, breathless ache back to my chest. I looked around and saw Pike breathing heavily and clutching his shoulder. One of the boys was kneeling on the chest of the other. They weren't wrestling anymore. Both were looking in my direction, stunned. I stared numbly at my hands, bloody where slivers of wood had pierced the skin.
"Little bastard bit me,"
Pike said quietly, as if he couldn't quite believe what had happened.
"Get off me,"
said the boy lying on his back.
"I said you shouldn't say those things. Look what happened."
Pike's expression twisted, and his face went a livid red.
"Bit me!"
he shouted, and swung a vicious kick at my head. I tried to get out of the way without doing any more damage to the loot. His kick caught me in the kidney and sent me sprawling into the wreckage again, splintering it even further.
"See what happens when you mock Tailu's name? Shut up about Tailu! Get off me and grab that thing! It might still be worth something to Dighton!" "Look what you did!"
Pike continued to howl above me. A kick caught me in the side and rolled me halfway over. The edges of my vision started to darken. I almost welcomed it as a distraction. But the deeper pain was still there, untouched. I balled my bloody hands into stinging fists.
"These knob things still seem okay. They're silvery, I'll bet we can get something for them."
Pike pulled back his foot again. I tried to put up my hands to keep it away, but my arms just twitched, and Pike kicked me in the stomach.
"Grab that bit over there!
Pike! Pike!"
Pike kicked me in the stomach again, and I vomited weakly onto the cobblestones.
"You there! Stop! City Watch!"
a new voice shouted. A heartbeat of stillness was followed by a scuffle and a flurry of pattering feet. A second later, heavy boots pounded past and faded in the distance. I remember the ache in my chest. I blacked out. I was shaken out of darkness by someone turning my pockets inside out. I tried unsuccessfully to open my eyes. I heard a voice muttering to itself.
"Is this all I get for saving your life? Copper and a couple of shims? Drinks for an evening, worthless little sod?"
He coughed deep in his chest, and the smell of stale liquor washed over me.
"Screaming like that, if you hadn't sounded like a girl, I wouldn't have run all this way."
I tried to say something, but it dribbled out as a groan.
"Well, you're alive, that's something, I suppose."
I heard a grunt as he stood up, then the heavy thumping of his boots faded away into silence. After a while, I found I could open my eyes. My vision was blurry and my nose felt larger than the rest of my head. I prodded it delicately, broken. Remembering what Ben had taught me, I put one hand on each side of it and twisted it sharply back into place. I clenched my teeth against a cry of pain and my eyes filled with tears. I blinked them away and was relieved when I saw the street without the painful blurriness of a moment ago. The contents of my small sack lay next to me on the ground. A half ball of string, a small dull knife, rhetoric and logic, and the remainder of a piece of bread the farmer had given me for lunch. It seemed like forever ago. The farmer. I thought of Seth and Jake. Soft bread and butter, songs while riding in a wagon. Their offer of a safe place, a new home. A sudden memory was followed by a sudden sickening panic. I looked around the alley, my head aching from the sudden movement. Sifting the garbage with my hands, I found some terribly familiar shards of wood. I stared at them mutely as the world darkened imperceptibly around me. I darted a look at the thin strip of sky visible overhead and saw it was purpling into twilight. How late was it? I hurried to gather my possessions, treating Ben's book more gently than the rest, and limped off in what I hoped was the direction of Seaward Square. The last of twilight had faded from the sky by the time I found the square. A few wagons rolled sluggishly among the few straggling customers. I limped wildly from corner to corner of the square, searching madly for the old farmer who had given me a ride, searching for the sight of one of those ugly, knobby squash. When I finally found the bookstore Seth had parked beside, I was panting and staggering. Seth and his wagon were nowhere to be seen. I sank down into the empty space their wagon had left and felt the aches and pains of a dozen injuries that I had forced myself to ignore. I felt them out, one by one. I had several painful ribs, although I couldn't tell if they were broken or if the cartilage was torn. I was dizzy and nauseous when I moved my head too quickly, probably a concussion. My nose was broken, and I had more bruises and scrapes than I could conveniently count. I was also hungry, the last being the only thing I could do anything about. I took what was left of my piece of bread from earlier in the day and ate it. It wasn't enough, but it was better than nothing. I took a drink from a horse trough, and was thirsty enough not to care that the water was brackish and sour. I thought of leaving, but it would take me hours of walking in my current condition. Besides, there was nothing waiting for me on the outskirts of the city except miles upon miles of harvested farmland, no trees to keep the wind away, no wood to make a fire, no rabbits to set traps for, no roots to dig, no heather for a bed. I was so hungry, my stomach was a hard knot. Here at least I could smell chicken cooking somewhere. I would have gone looking for the smell, but I was dizzy and my ribs hurt. Maybe tomorrow someone would give me something to eat. Right now I was too tired. I wanted nothing more than to sleep. The cobblestones were losing the last of the sun's heat and the wind was picking up. I moved back into the doorway of the bookshop to get out of the wind. I was almost asleep when the owner of the shop opened the door and kicked at me, telling me to shove off or he'd call the guard. I limped away as quickly as I could. After that, I found some empty crates in an alley. I curled up behind them, bruised and weary. I closed my eyes and tried not to remember what it was like to go to sleep warm and full, surrounded by people who loved you. That was the first night of nearly 3 years I spent in Tarbin. Chapter 21 Basement, Bread and Bucket. It was just after lunchtime. Rather, it would have been after lunchtime if I'd had anything to eat. I was begging in Merchant Circle, and so far the day had profited me 2 kicks, 1 guard, 1 mercenary, 3 shoves, 2 wagoneers, 1 sailor, One new curse concerning an unlikely anatomical configuration, also from the sailor, and a spray of spittle from a rather unendearing elderly man of indeterminate occupation. And one iron shim, though I attributed it more to the laws of probability than from any human kindness. Even a blind pig finds an acorn once in a while. I had been living in Tarbeen for nearly a month, and the day before I had tried my hand at stealing for the first time. It was an inauspicious beginning. I'd been caught with my hand in a butcher's pocket. This had earned me such a tremendous blow to the side of the head that today I was dizzy when I tried to stand or move about quickly. Hardly encouraged by my first foray into thievery, I had decided that today was a begging day. As such, it was about average. Hunger knotted my stomach, and a single shim's worth of stale bread wasn't going to help much. I was considering moving to a different street when I saw a boy run up to a younger beggar across the way. They talked excitedly for a moment, then hurried off. I followed, of course, showing a pale shadow of my former burning curiosity. Besides, anything that moved the two of them away from a busy street corner in the middle of the day was bound to be worth my while. Maybe the tellines were giving out bread again, or a fruit cart had tipped over, or the guard was hanging someone. That would be worth half an hour of my time. I followed the boys through the twisting streets until I saw them turn a corner and scurry down a flight of stairs into the basement of a burned-out building. I stopped, the dim spark of curiosity smothered by my common sense. A moment later they reappeared, each carrying a chunk of flat brown bread. I watched as they wandered past, laughing and shoving at each other. The youngest, no more than 6, saw me looking and waved.
"Still some left,"
he called through a mouthful of bread.
"Better hurry up, though."
My common sense did a rapid turnaround, and I headed cautiously downward. At the bottom of the steps were a few rotting planks, all that remained of a broken door. Inside, I could see a short hallway opening out into a dimly lit room. A young girl with hard eyes pushed past me without looking up. She clutched another piece of bread. I stepped over the broken pieces of door into the chill, damp dark. After a dozen steps, I heard a low moan that froze me where I stood. It was almost an animal sound, but my ear told me it came from a human throat. I don't know what I expected, but it was nothing like what I found. 2 ancient lamps burned fish oil, throwing dim shadows against the dark stone walls. There were 6 cots in the room, all occupied. 2 children that were hardly more than babies shared a blanket on the stone floor, and another was curled up in a pile of rags. A boy my age sat in a dark corner, his head pressed against the wall. One of the boys moved slightly on his cot, as if stirring in his sleep. But something was wrong with the movement. It was too strained, too tense. I looked closer and saw the truth. He was tied to the cot. All of them were. He strained against the ropes and made the noise I had heard in the hall. It was clearer now. A long, moaning cry. For a moment, all I could do was think about every story I had ever heard about the Duke of Gibeah, about how he and his men had abducted and tortured people for 20 years before the church had gone in and put an end to it.
What?
Came a voice from the other room. The voice had an odd inflection to it, as if it wasn't really asking a question. The boy on the cot jerked against his ropes. A man came through the doorway, brushing his hands on the front of his tattered robe.
What?
He repeated in the same not-questioning tone. His voice was old and tired around the edges, but at its center it was patient. Patient as a heavy stone, or a mother cat with kittens. Not the sort of voice I expected a Duke of Gibeah type to have.
What? Hush, Tanny. I wasn't gone, just stepped away. Now I'm here.
His feet made slapping sounds against the bare stone floor. He was barefoot. I felt the tension slowly spill out of me. Whatever was going on here, it didn't seem nearly as sinister as I had originally thought. The boy